from sunny St. Leonard's on the south coast of the UK. This is the Keto Woman Podcast, brought to you by me, Daisy Brackenhall. Hello, keto lovelies, and welcome to episode number 217, where I am joined by Dan Grief for a crossover with his podcast, UK Low Carb. Now, you might just remember that Dan was on the podcast about a year ago when I had him on my podcast to chat about his story and tell me more about his business, Deliciously Guilt-Free. As is the case this time, we ran long and it stretched over two episodes. And this time, as I mentioned, it's a crossover, so it will be going out on his podcast as well. So we were kind of taking it in turns to interview each other. But we were also really, I guess, having a chat about our podcasts, but podcasting in general. And then I ended up telling the story of my move back to the UK, which ended up being very long-winded, took about half an hour, ended up taking up most of the first episode. So you may or may not find that interesting, as we discussed later on. You always have the option of fast-forwarding or skipping to the next episode. But hopefully you will enjoy a bit of a behind-the-scenes chat, a chat about how we make our podcasts, some of the thought processes that go on behind the scenes. If you are in the UK, or indeed outside the UK, you might be familiar with Dan's podcast, UK Low Carb, but also with his business, Deliciously Guilt-Free. And he does make some exceedingly good cakes, it has to be said. And he's also branching out now into other things like chocolate, which is very, very exciting. Indeed, he has promised to send me some of his milk chocolate to try. I missed out on ordering some and there was a very limited quantity up for sale. So I'm really looking forward to trying out his milk chocolate. Because as you know, milk chocolate is difficult. Dark chocolate is easy really, isn't it, on keto? But milk chocolate generally is really difficult. And especially here in the UK, there aren't really very many options available. So, you know me, always excited to try new products, so I can't wait to get my chops around that. But before we get stuck into our chat, here's a quick roundup of my week. It's mostly been high tide this week in the mornings when I go down to the sea, which always makes it a little bit more problematic, even if it's a little bit wavy. But I have managed to go in every morning and the sea was particularly calm this morning and absolutely lovely. But I am getting pretty good these days at assessing whether I'm going to be able to make it out reasonably unscathed, even if it is a bit choppy. Having said that, I still did manage to get knocked sideways and nearly taken off my feet as I was coming out. But I righted myself and pushed forward and made it out unscathed. It's been pretty dreary weather-wise, but very mild. So not those lovely frosty blue-skied mornings that I really like. But it does make it a lot easier when you're coming out and getting changed and it's not too cold or too windy. The on-again, off-again cold symptoms are back a bit. Have quite a lot of catarrh and this really irritating, persistent dry cough. And before you ask, I do weekly lateral flow tests and I haven't got any other COVID symptoms. So I've definitely ruled that out. So it's either just some weird cold that's lurking around or actually probably more likely a sort of cumulative sensitivity to dairy and maybe nuts, I think, is the latest potential culprit that I'm going to have to go without for a while. As you know, if you've been listening to me recently, you'll know I've been mostly off dairy. I have been having it a little bit on and off over the last month or so, but preceding that, I had a good solid couple of months without it at all. And there's no denying that it does have an impact on me, and kind of a bit of those sort of cold symptoms tends to sort of mostly affect me in my nose. Within an hour of eating it, I get a bit of a blocked up nose. And I think maybe this sort of residual snotty stuff and the dry cough has something to do with that. But like I say, I'm also suspecting nut butters, in this case, peanut butter. So I think I'm going to have a period without. And although it is easy enough to do, it's one of those things for me anyway, that's kind of easier said than done. You know, the toddler comes out in me and I do get a bit foot stampy and sulky when I have to give up something that I like. You know, I love keto. I love the freedom it's afforded me. For the most part, I just love the foods. I love the selection of food that's available to me. And I really love the fact that I've been able to maintain most of the weight loss that I achieved through weight loss surgery. I mean, a lot of the way I was eating post-surgery was moderate, getting into low carb. But I really can't say that I lost all the weight due to keto. It was really only something that I came across when I started to regain some weight. I'd naturally been heading more towards a moderate, sometimes low carb, certainly a whole food diet approach. I had my own sort of diet rules that came in. And I very quickly actually made that change naturally after the weight loss surgery, just because I was feeling hungry all the time, eating the way they told me to eat, basically. But where the low carb approach, the keto approach, has really helped me is maintaining that weight loss, or at least within, for me anyway, what is an acceptable regain window. And I know that if I was to really tighten things up, I could lose the 10 kilos that in an ideal world I would like to lose to be my quote unquote perfect weight. But I can happily maintain, as I am, eating what I consider a fairly indulgent and luxurious keto diet. And that has included having treats like dark chocolate and peanut butter and dairy. And so, like I say, it has felt pretty indulgent. And so I do get a bit sulky and foot stampy when I have to take those things out, not from a weight loss point of view, but from a it could be causing these other symptoms point of view, which is silly really in a way, isn't it? But you know, we are talking about the irrational toddler part of me. So I'm going to have a period where I go back to being completely dairy free, which actually was nowhere near as difficult as I thought it was going to be. And I've quite happily settled into a mostly dairy free day to day diet, actually. But taking out the nut butters is going to be a bit of a struggle, but I'll do it. Probably will get pushed back to the new year. But until you try it, you really don't know. And these persistent, fairly low level, but annoying symptoms are enough of a push to make me want to try. And maybe that won't be the answer, but maybe it will. You don't know until you try. And it might just be a bit of a cumulative thing that I've been having a little bit too much for a little bit too long. And sometimes a period without means that you can have it from time to time without any symptoms at all, or maybe just some mild symptoms. But having that period with nothing and then testing, you can be really very clear which the culprits are or not. And then the search goes on to figure out what's going on. And I do quite like that sort of detective side of it, figuring out problems for yourself. Because quite often, if you don't figure these things out, they're not going to get figured out. So that's pretty much it. I'm super busy at the moment trying to get ahead with some editing, trying to just keep up with editing and try not to think about the building work that needs to be going on, really. I'm quite happy that the builder was actually supposed to be turning up and doing some work this week, and I've seen no sign of him, but I haven't been on his case because I was really kind of hoping that he wasn't going to show up. So I'm assuming that he probably won't be around until the new year, and actually that suits me, because although I'm not doing any of the work with him, I found every single time that they're here, it's very difficult to get stuff done. Yes, you can get things done, but there's lots of noise and frequent interruptions. Never mind just the general upheaval. So it's always super, super disruptive. So I'm not at all bothered that that's being pushed back to sometime in the future, but it really does need getting on with, and there's so much that I need to do. But, you know, I've only got one set of hands and there are more important things I need to focus on at the moment. There's a couple of nice things coming up. There's a bit of a get together in the dog walking park that I go to, a little bit of an informal outside Christmas gathering on Saturday, which will be nice. Then I'm going round the coast a bit on Monday for a friend's birthday. So I'm hoping the weather's going to be on my side, as it's a reasonably long drive. But other than that, that's me. I'll leave you now with the first part of my chat with Dan Grief. Welcome, welcome, Dan Grief, to the Keto Woman podcast. We are you might want to do a welcome to me, because we are doing a crossover. Yeah.
Yeah, welcome also, Daisy, to UK Low Carb. You know what? I think it's about a year ago we did our last recording.
Well, funnily enough, yes, I was just thinking about that before we hit record, and it was pretty well a year ago today.
Because you were at the time getting ready to move to the UK.
That's right.
And we were talking a bit about Christmas, and I remember clearly, because the other day I was eating a French-style sausage, and I remember you saying one of the things you were missing the most was a British sausage, and you wanted to come back and have one.
That's right. I eat them every day.
I was going to say, how's your last 365 days been since you've been here? Sausage heavy?
Definitely sausage heavy. Yes, I am one of those people who will quite happily eat the same breakfast every day. So yes, bacon, sausage, egg, every single day. Perfectly happy to continue like that.
Well, that's not exactly
like
a bad breakfast choice, is it, really?
No, that's right.
It's not like eating Weetabix every day or some muck like that. So, but on a serious note, I was just going to ask really about the move and how that was. Now, you know, in 2020, we were talking very much about the pandemic and the lockdowns. And 2021, everyone had this, I thought, kind of optimistic hope that 2021 would be so much better. And of course, I suspected it would be very much a continuation of 2020. But you were moving in the middle of that as well. So I was just going to ask you a bit about how that all went.
It was hell. It was hellish. More really just, it was a stack of things that happened a certain way that just made it an absolute nightmare. You know, when you're experiencing something and you know in the moment that it's a hellish experience, but that it's going to make quite a good story later on. So you're just kind of waiting for that period of getting through it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that you can look back on it, not with fondness, but at least with this is quite a good story. So yes, I remember having the conversation with you about moving and how it was so of the time with all the difficulties that came with it. You know, we not only had, I guess really, COVID was the thing that dictated the experience a lot, but then the actual move itself, Brexit, came into just causing nightmares as well. What Brexit brought to the table was endless, seemingly anyway, paperwork that you had to do to make the move, and lots of personal annoyances. Like, I'd spent that last year that I spent in my place in France, because I'd been wanting to move for a decade, I should imagine, at least, and the place had been on and off the market. And I was just about to put it back on the market. I'd spent the winter before, I'd spoken to an estate agent. I said, look, you know, what do I need to do to get this place sold? I've decided, you know, next year is the year I'm going to move back. What do I need to do to get it ready without spending too much money, too much time? I just want to, you know, get it done. So he said, yeah, you know, you've got to redo this terrace at the back that's rotting. Yes, I knew that. Do these steps at the front, tidy this up, tidy that up. Don't bother with this, don't bother with that. He actually said, don't bother finishing the kitchen. But I did, because I wanted to. And I think that helped. But I got those things done over the winter. I worked really hard over the winter. And then just as we were coming, just as I was thinking of launching in the spring, as you do, the whole world changed. So I didn't launch when I thought I was going to launch. But it was kind of nice. I kind of fell back in love with the place because I'd done those things. So I had a nice kitchen to spend time in. I had a nice new decking area to spend time in. I grew some things from seed again, enjoyed spending time outside. Kind of, yeah, fell back in love with it.
Oh, how lovely.
Knowing that I was probably going to be leaving, you know, fingers crossed if I could sell it. And I did end up putting it on the market in the autumn and sold it within 2 weeks. It was just
fantastic.
One of those crazy things.
Wow.
And weirdly, actually, it was COVID that helped that.
Yeah.
It was the typical kind of move that has been going on here as well, with people wanting to move out of the city.
Yeah.
So it was a Parisian couple who were in a flat in Paris. I think they all ended up having COVID at some point.
Right.
And just desperately wanted to get out and start a new life in the country, basically. Weird overlaps with me. You know, she is a gardener and was setting up a gardening business. So handily, she could take over the few remaining gardening jobs that I had and things like that. So she was moving one way, I was moving the other way. So yes, COVID made it very complicated. I think I remember telling you how I wouldn't see this place until I physically moved into it, until I turned the key that first time and
yes,
stepped
through
the
remember,
door.
Yes, I do remember, because your sister
That's right.
had been there, but you hadn't yet.
That's right. She looked around it. She was brilliant. She took videos of it. So I virtually walked around it hundreds of times. And so I kind of did know the place pretty well, but until I stepped through it that first time, that was the, you know, the first time that I'd physically been in it. So that was kind of exciting and worrying
Great.
Too, of course.
Yeah.
But Brexit just brought so much, all the bureaucracy. Literally, you know, the 31st of December, the difference in what you had to do on the 31st of December and the 1st of January was incredible. There was all this new paperwork, and I mean, we won't go into talking about how inept the government is. We'll just take that as read. But they were insisting on all these new things that had to happen, but they hadn't actually put things in place properly anyway to make it relatively easy for the people on the ground who suddenly had to apply all these rules, but they didn't have any systems really in place and how to do it. So everyone was kind of doing it a different way, and you would get these ridiculous things. Like the removals guy told me this story about people moving their animals back, which you can imagine was a real concern for me. And the vets have to do a check. I think it was for the dogs. And you have to have the worming treatment more than a day, less than 5 days. And they have to sign in a box saying they've done it. Well, these people get to the port at, I don't know, wherever it was, Calais, say. And the vet hadn't signed completely inside the box. Their signature had gone a fraction outside the box.
Which is very easy to do with signatures, isn't it?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
But, you know, they'd signed it. They'd done what they needed to do and they'd signed it. They would not let them cross until that paperwork had been redone with the signature completely in the box. So there was also a case of people on the ground being jobs worth and getting their kicks out of causing problems. So that was going on as well. And I'd spent the summer putting together a collection of plants so that I could start my garden when I got here. But that rule changed overnight. Removals people used to be able to move plants backwards and forwards for personal use.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, overnight, that changed. So the only plants I could take back were those that I could cram into my car. So I was pretty devastated about that.
Blimey
so there
heck,
were all these things that changed overnight that just made it really, really difficult. And then, of course, there were all the COVID restrictions that were in place. Luckily, the whole mandatory hotel staying in didn't apply to me. But the new system of having to have the day 2 and 8 testing and quarantining for 10 days when you arrived, that came into place just a couple of days, I think, or the day I traveled, something like that. So
wow.
That all of a sudden, not quite last minute, but pretty last minute, I had to organize all those things and get those sorted, as well as, you know, the tests I had to have before I left and setting this up and setting that up. And there was a curfew where you weren't supposed to be traveling outside certain hours in France. And, you know, so I had a hotel booked halfway, which, as it turns out, this is where the truly hellish...
It's getting worse.
Yeah.
Okay, I love the way
so
I was thinking.
I'm just building it up for you.
I was thinking, and now she's sat eating her sausages and eggs and bacon, and she's happily moved in, and it's all worked out well. But actually, that's just the warm up to the real nightmare.
Oh yes,
okay.
that was the easy bit.
Brace yourself, everyone.
I had
brace
it
yourself.
All planned out, and I'd even started my packing really early. But as much packing as you think you've done, you've left far more to the end.
Yeah.
Than you thought you had. So all these other things that I had to do, that, you know, the day before the move, I had to go and get the animals sorted. I had to get my test done. You know, I had it set up so that all the animals were going into kennels the day before the move, and they were being picked up by the transport people the day after I'd moved, so they wouldn't have to deal with the whole move. I took Bets with me, because actually you were only allowed to take 5 animals and I had 6. So, you know.
Oh my word. And you can't exactly just leave one behind, or, you know, that's
no,
awful, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. So Bets was my travel companion. And so, you know, I had it all set up and I thought I had it all planned well. The removals people were going to be loading the removals van up. As they were moving everything out, I'd be cleaning the house down behind. I'd leave about half an hour after they did, at which point it would be sort of early to mid-afternoon. I would get to the hotel, which was about just over halfway, have a nice sleep, get on the ferry the next morning. Perfect. You know, it was going to be tiring, but it would be okay.
Yeah.
And I'd already decided, I planned I would fast. Certainly on the day of the move. One, because practically it would be
a
pain in the bum to be cooking.
Yeah.
But also, I have a tendency to find it difficult to sleep when I'm fasting. So I thought, aha, I will play this to my advantage, because that will be good. You know, when I tend to get, especially if I'm already a bit sleepy, a long drive, and I just want to go to sleep. So
right.
I thought, well, I'll do all these things to make my life easier. So it was all set up really well.
Can I just ask on that point for a second, actually, Daisy?
I
find if I'm on the road, and of course the only kind of signs of life you're going to get are service stations and maybe a ferry shop or whatever.
Mm.
I don't know about you, but I certainly find that environment can be a little bit triggering sometimes if I'm stressed as well. So planning to fast, or planning ahead your food so that you've got things with you that are going to keep you going, like eggs are great for that, aren't they?
That's right.
So that you're going to be filled up and keep going really helps you. Whereas I think playing it by ear, like, oh, I'll just get something on the ferry, you know it's going to be ultra-processed rubbish, don't you?
That's right. No, so yeah, I mean, I find that's a whole other conversation. It's something that I've thought over and over again. Oh yeah, it'll be all right.
Yeah,
no, then, putting a plan in
and
place.
And then the crack zero appears,
that's
and
right.
Next thing you know, you're drinking it. Yeah,
yeah. Exactly. Oh yes.
I know you well. I'm gonna be saying that, yeah.
You do. Definitely an abstainer when it comes to crack zero, or I have to be. If I'm not,
yeah,
all bets are off and I start mainlining it. But, you know, good plan. It was going to be fine. But I wasn't as well prepared as I thought I was. And I was frantically, they got there a little bit early and started packing up the day before. And so it was just a nightmare. There was stuff all over the place. I was trying to finish packing as they were taking things out. Long story short, on the day of the move, I don't think That's right. So I didn't get much sleep on the Monday night. Tuesday was when they arrived. Wednesday was the day of the move. I did not get any sleep on Tuesday night. I pulled an all-nighter trying to get ready because I knew
the
I was I was behind. Yet still on the Wednesday, the day of the move, I was still frantically packing. They did indeed finish about when I thought they would. They left at about 2-3 o'clock. It was also extremely muddy, so the house was filthy. They had a shower, left at about 3 o'clock, which point I still had packing to do. I still had my car to load up. It's the middle of winter, so it got dark at 4 o'clock.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to pack the car by the light of my mobile phone and finish the packing, and then I've got to clean the house, you know. So I think it was about 8 o'clock at night by the time I'd finished packing the car. Then I had to clean the house, and I was drop dead tired at this point. And my mum said, just go, just leave. I said, I can't, it's filthy. So I gave it a reasonable clean. It wasn't as clean as I would have liked. I finally left at 10 o'clock at night with the car loaded with me and with Bets and with all the rubbish that had to go to the bins on the way. I get to the bins, I drop the rubbish off, and suddenly this thought goes through my mind. I don't know where Bets's passport is.
Oh my word. Quite important.
Yeah.
Even pre-Brexit, that was important.
So I'm panicking and I look to where my passport is, and my passport's there, fine. I can't find her passport. What am I going to do? I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm like at the point of having a mini nervous breakdown.
I'm not surprised. And also, it could be anywhere. It's not like you've got a house full of stuff and it's going to be always in that drawer or the other place you put stuff. It's all been moved. So it could be on
a van
off to Britain already.
Right.
It could be in your car. It could be on the ground. You'd have no idea.
Yeah. So I'm like, what did I do? Did I put her passport in with the animals' passports and it's at the kennels?
Yeah.
I'll phone the kennels guy and see if I can find out.
Bear in mind, this is after 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah, we're at like past 10 o'clock at night now.
So trying to get hold of people is going to be pretty difficult.
Yeah. And then for some reason, my phone's not working. So I'm like, oh, okay, what am I going to do? Because maybe I could phone the vet and get like an emergency replacement or something, but my phone's not working. Okay, so I've got to go somewhere where there's a phone working. So I drive to a friend's house. Bear in mind, it's curfew, so you're not supposed to be out on the road. By the time I turn up to her house, it's like 11 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
She's sort of peering out
I'm
the
leaving.
Window.
I thought I'd say goodbye.
Exactly. Who the hell is here at 11 o'clock at night? It's me. She opens the door. By this time, I am on the brink of just going over the edge of that cliff. So I just start like bawling. I am crying my eyes out. I don't know what to do. I can't find Bets's passport. I'm supposed to be on a ferry tomorrow morning. I don't know. I don't know what I'm going to do. She's like,
this is awful,
come in, calm down. Where might the passport be? So I'm like, well, it could be in, maybe it went in the rubbish. Maybe it's somewhere in the car. So she said, well, okay, well, let's have a cup of coffee. We'll go through the car, then we'll go back to the bins if needs be.
It's almost like you needed that person to be your rational brain when you're in the middle of the emotional mess. You know, I know what you mean. When you're going through something like that, your brain is completely tangled up in it all, so it can't think straight. But actually, you need somebody to say, let's just break it down into what's manageable and have a look, which, you know, that's what friends are there for, aren't they?
Exactly. So we start pulling the car out. But so bearing in mind, it's dark, you know, so we're holding torches trying to light our way. And I pull out my suitcase. I open the suitcase. Oh, yeah, no, it's not in here. But, you know, and I pick up this little wash bag. As I'm opening it, the memory comes back.
Yeah.
This is Bets's wash bag. She has problems with her eyes and her ears and different stuff. And all of her stuff was in this wash bag.
Right.
And all of a sudden, the memory comes back to me. I'll put her part, because at the time, there was all this paperwork everywhere. Everything was a mess. I'll put her passport in this safe place that's Bets's bag so that it's where it needs to be for when I need it. And the memory came back. and the relief just flooded out. I had Bet's passport. Everything was going to be okay.
Fantastic.
But the last leg was that I then had to, she insisted that I came in, had more coffee, plied me with coffee. I think I left hers at 1 o'clock in the morning. And so I then had to drive through the night to get to the ferry.
Hang on, because did you say you hadn't slept the night before as well?
Exactly.
My goodness, this is dangerous, right. Isn't it?
So at that point, I'm at about 48 hours of not having slept. And so that decision to fast probably saved my life. But even as it was, I worked out I had enough time to stop three times, have some coffee, have a 15-minute nap.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. The other thing that really made that journey super pleasurable was the fact that I'd had my local garage change the headlights back from French headlights to English headlights, which right. I'd kept from when I'd done it the other way around. Mm-hmm. And I'd asked them to put the, you know, those stickers on
the
that
strips
make
that
it,
you put on the lights. Yeah. Yeah. Doesn't it shine slightly into the road? Isn't that the idea? Or away from the other side of the road?
That's right.
So you, don't, you don't blind somebody as you're coming up to them.
They're angled the wrong way because you're on the wrong side of the road. And so, yeah, you're blinding people coming the other way. And they said, oh, that's fine. You won't need it. It's only when you're on full beam that it's going to be a problem. Okay, that's fine. I trust your judgment. You're, you know, you're the expert. That was not the case. And mostly who was on the road but lorries. So every single lorry coming the other way, because my headlights, and there was nothing I could do about it, they weren't on full beam, but they were angled the wrong way. Every single lorry flashed on full beam.
Oh,
so
my
it blinded
word.
Me. Yeah, so you can imagine, I'm really tired, I'm really stressed, and I've got every lorry coming the other way is coming up full beam.
Angry
and trying
at
to
you,
blind me.
Thinking you're just being, ridiculous.
So to be honest, I'm not quite sure how I made it to the ferry port, but I made it to the ferry port with, I think, 20 minutes to spare. I got on the ferry and the removal guys were on the same ferry and they took one look at me and Bets. And they said, right, we're going to go and have a quick, because I couldn't book a cabin. It was only the lorry guys who could book cabins. They said, we're going to have a quick shower and then you're taking our cabin and you're going to go and lie down.
So you know what? I know what you said at the beginning about having a story that you can look back on and laugh and tell. And I think life's like that sometimes. You know, I've heard stand-up comedians say this. They say that, you know, they were out in public, something horrific happened, they were embarrassed, whatever it might be. But it meant that they had a story to tell in the future. And that story could be funny, because of course they're comedians. But actually, I think that storytelling, and this very much relates to what we do with our podcast, that storytelling is such a human quality thing that we can relate to. It gives you empathy. It brings you into someone's life. I mean, I was painting pictures in my mind as you're talking, and I'm sure listeners are as well, because that story, I'm just there with you at that time. And the fact that those drivers gave you their cabin, that's just wonderful. And that wouldn't have happened if you hadn't been challenged so much. So in the long term, even though it's horrific at the time, that is a little insight into what humans can do to look out for each other.
Oh, yes. And I mean, that stacked up on the other side too. You know, we landed, I think it was the 11 to, I don't know, got in early afternoon, 2 o'clock or something, crossing. I landed where were we? We were middle of February, so it was cold, but the sun was shining. And I think I cried as we pulled in to New Haven, you know, and it felt like I'm home. I'm really home. And then I had the drive to get here. And I got here on my phone because I thought, oh, my phone will start working when I'm in the UK. It'll be something about that, because it was a British pay-as-you-go phone. It always worked. But for some reason, it wasn't working. It didn't work when I got here. And I had to phone the builder who had the key. But as it turned out, he turned up and they were fantastic. I think he could see how tired I was. And they helped. Everything had to come in through the windows. It wasn't.
Oh, really?
Most of my stuff is still in storage. Yeah.
Right.
But I had a van full of things, the basic things that I needed, which is what I'm still using because, you know, builders. But most of the stuff had to come through the windows because it's such a tight access. It's down some steps, the basement door. And the bed, the frame of the bed wouldn't even go through the window. So bless him. Wow. He and his wife went out and they took it to pieces and they brought it in and they put my bed back together. And they, yeah, they really helped. And yeah, and then I had a good sleep. And actually that 10 days of quarantine
that helped.
Was quite good. The rest of the animals arrived the next evening. And yeah, the rest is
That's
history.
Hard too, because you're moving a whole family in then, aren't you? I mean, animals are very territorial. Well, we all are as animals, but they're very territorial. So this is a new space for them. It must be quite hard to get them used to their new environment and settle in as well, I suppose.
And they're very nervous. Mm. I mean, Rocket especially, but as a breed, Potenkos are anxious creatures. So it was obviously very, very scary for them. And we came in. The way it works is I have a maisonette, the basement and the ground floor. So weirdly, the ground floor door is the access to the upper maisonette. To get to mine, you have to go down to the basement door. And then the living area is on the ground floor and the door out to the garden is on the ground floor. So you come down steps to get in and then you come up steps to get to the living area.
Right.
And the dogs came up the upstairs and they actually refused to go back down those steps.
It's not logical, Mum. We don't like it.
Exactly. Until the first day I took them out for a walk. So they didn't attempt those steps. And they weren't used to steps because they didn't go upstairs in France. So they weren't used to steps.
Right.
But they've come on enormously. I was really worried, especially about him, that I'd be pushing him too much out of his comfort zone. But it turns out that pushing him out of his comfort zone was a good thing for him. And he's changed huge, huge amounts over this last
That's amazing.
Year.
So can I ask you a question about home? Because you said you felt like you came home. How long were you living in France for?
17 years.
So that is a heck of a long time to feel like you're coming home. Isn't that interesting? Now, you must have had a big community in France because you're there such a long time. You say about your friend who helped you find the passport. So you definitely had a community there you belong to.
That's right.
And I imagine, apart from family, it must be quite hard to have that in the UK after 17 years. You might know some people from going back a long time, but you probably didn't see them as frequently. And yet still, something about coming to the UK felt like home. Can you tell me a bit about that? Is it language-based? Is it culture-based? Is it What is it based on?
Both those things. I underestimated how culturally different the French are. You know, it's just across the channel. We're all Europeans. We were. But we are all in Europe and we are still all in Europe.
Yeah, I haven't changed the geography.
in terms of geography, exactly. So how different can they be? But culturally, yes, they are very, very different, actually. And there is an undercurrent of antagonism, really.
Right.
I think we have a sort of joking don't like the French. The French have less of a joking don't like the British, really.
Right.
And that's not to say that is definitely a generalization, but there is that undercurrent going on. There's also, which I didn't know until I got there, you're very much disliked as a single woman.
Really?
Single men are embraced and taken in and invited to dinner all the time. Single women are dangerous, you
wow.
know. Yeah, I mean, I wasn't, but...
Is it like a cultural thing and like almost a Christian or Catholic kind of family values and,
maybe,
you know, women should have a role in society? I mean, I don't want to stereotype because I don't know, but that seems very antiquated to me.
Yes, I think that might be part of it. I don't know whether the whole stereotype of French men having their mistresses has something to do with it as well. Who knows? But there were all these kind of things that made it difficult to fit in.
Yeah.
And I've certainly seen other people who find it a lot easier to fit in if they have families and children at the local schools and things like that. But
I think that's normal anyway. I think for what I've found in Cambridge,
that's probably true.
Moving here like in 2012, I was a single guy. So I very much felt like Norwich was my home. And going back to see my parents and my sister who lives there, that was going back home. And I didn't really feel like I belonged in Cambridge, even though I worked outside of the city. I kind of knew people through different organizations I'm part of, but not massively well. But as soon as I had children and I got married and had a family, it completely changed because you just connect with people on a different level. I think you've got more excuses to bump into people through schools, nurseries, all of those things. But also you've got this kind of common thing of, oh, well, actually having kids is quite hard, so do you want to go to a soft play together and do something so it makes it a bit easier? Whereas I think I could easily spend time by myself very happily. When you've got kids, you're thinking of stuff to do, and so it's naturally more sociable. I think that's kind of quite a normal thing, really.
Yes, it's an automatic way in, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
But yeah, so there are all those kind of differences, and you underestimate, as good as you get at a language, it tends to just sort of roll over you. And I always noticed that when I came back here to visit friends and family, that all of a sudden you were connected into the conversations going on around you. You know, you started eavesdropping on all those conversations you could hear. That in France was just kind of noise, just became background noise. You didn't tune into it. Or certainly I didn't. I just kind of zoned out to stuff.
Yeah.
And at some point as well, I think in France, when I decided I wasn't going to stay, I didn't make as much effort as some other people make to integrate. So I'd made that decision I wasn't going to stay there fairly early. So there's all those kind of things that made coming back feel like home. Also, the area that I had chosen was familiar territory to me. I grew up in the southeast, and I spent a lot of time a bit closer up into London, Greater London, but we moved to not far away from where I am now, about half an hour up inland. And I used to drive down to Hastings quite often to come and, you know, look at the sea and spend time down here. I liked it. So it's an area I'm familiar with. So it kind of felt a bit like home from that point of view. The southeast, I guess because that's where I grew up, has always felt a bit more like home. The accents, you know, so straight away, just hearing that southeast accent reminded me of where I grew up. It reminded me of the woman who weirdly lives just down the road from me almost now. She lives along the coast at Bexhill, who I have always been so fond of. It just reminded me of her. I also maintain that there's something about the southeast that is very, very friendly. It has a reputation of not being so, but I've always found the opposite. And that's certainly what I found and have found here, that the people are just so friendly.
That's wonderful.
And you talk about that having kids as being, you know, an automatic way in to a community. Well, for me, it's been the dogs.
Yes, yeah.
So almost immediately somebody told me about this particular gardens that's a private gardens that you pay a membership to. But the good thing about it is that it's fenced. So it's somewhere that I felt safe, although he was on a long lead for a while, Rocket that is. I felt safe enough to let him off. So it was somewhere I could take the dogs off for a lead. And of course, you're seeing the same people just as you are. If you're taking your kids to the school and seeing people at the school gates, you're seeing the same people when you take the dogs for a walk.
Yeah.
And a woman in there who'd recommended it to me, she mentioned that she'd been wanting to get into swimming in the sea. And I said, well, so have I.
I was going to ask you about this. Yeah. Because those pictures were very impressive. This was last winter, wasn't it? And I was like, blimey, you're swimming in the sea. Are you still doing that now? I know we're recording this in like early December-ish when it's freezing right now. So are you still going out swimming at the moment?
Every morning.
Wow, impressive.
Yeah.
Great for autophagy, isn't it?
And it's, usually at the moment, or quite often anyway, it's warmer in the sea than out of it. I went down the other day and there was frost on the pebbles, must have been close to freezing, and the sea was 9 degrees, I think.
Nine? So, wow, what a difference.
Yeah.
But I guess coming out of the water must be awful.
Well, weirdly not, no. The worst time from a feeling cold point of view is when you take everything off, you're all nice and warm and cozy, and you take everything off and you're in there. I don't do the wetsuit thing, so it's swimming costume. I do have gloves and boots, which make a huge difference, but it's from there getting in. But once you're in, Michael McIntyre does a good sketch about, oh, it's all right once you're in. It's lovely once you're in. But it's true.
So getting in, that's a
but
hard
once
bit,
you're in, and you've acclimatized to that. But then obviously you start, your body starts getting colder. And as you're coming out, you have, if you get the timing right, you actually feel a lot warmer. And so that bit getting out is fine.
Right.
And as long as you get your clothes on relatively quickly and you get into this thing called after drop, where your core carries on getting colder for the next 10 minutes or so.
Oh.
So you get wrapped up, and just as you're dressed and you're swaddled up and should be nice and warm is actually when you feel your coldest. And
oh,
then you start,
I see.
The temperature.
So how long do you go into the
up?
C4 knowing you've got this extra 10 minutes? You have to probably time the amount of time in the water, do you?
I tend to just do it by how I feel
okay.
these days, but it's usually, I'm only in there for usually about 10 to 20 minutes maximum. Weirdly, when I started doing it, we would stay in for longer, probably too long actually. And I went with somebody else, and you kind of stay in because they're staying in, whatever, and we'd be in for half an hour or so. And then it can be difficult to warm up.
Yeah,
but
I
tend to just stay in for as long as I feel like.
That's cool.
Really. Yeah.
Blimey neck. So I'd love to, if I can, talk about the podcasts and how the year has been. And
yes, we got sidetracked there with an extremely
really
long
story.
Let's get on to what we're supposed to be here to talk about.
I sort of let people into behind the scenes a little bit as well, because I guess, unlike any other guest I've had, and probably vice versa, if people aren't used to how podcasts are made, it's quite interesting to talk about the process as well a little bit. And and I thought we could talk about that, and also the challenges of you moving to a new country and how you've managed to run a podcast, because there's a lot of work goes into podcast making. I know that for sure. And, you know, we do this voluntarily. It's a big deal. But when you have a podcast going for such a long time, like we do, and especially you, you know, is that kind of thing of consistency is key, and wanting to still put up episodes, even when you're going through a hard time, when you're sick or you're stressed or you're moving, whatever it might be. So there's a lot of that side of podcasting. But also, I think we are so lucky and privileged, because there seems to be, in my opinion anyway, with the way social media is and the way that people portray themselves in the media and social media, that vulnerability is not something that really is displayed often in our societies and around the world. And actually, as a podcast host, because it's long form and we really get to have proper conversation with people and get to listen to what they say, we really are able to kind of scratch beneath the surface and get to the real heart of what's going on with somebody. And I think that, for me, is probably one of the biggest privileges of having a podcast. And I thought it'd be lovely to discuss that with you and some of the things that have maybe come up this last year for you in terms of podcasting. Does that sound like a good plan?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I mean, I feel like I've been talking for ages. We should talk a little bit about you and the changes, because this has been quite a big year for you too. I mean, I've seen your business develop hugely. I've seen your podcast develop a lot too. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So ending 2020, where everything changed, that was a year of huge change for me. So I started the podcast in 2020. I didn't start Deliciously Guilt Free, but it took off in 2020 as well. I had a very rough kind of summer and autumn up until the podcast, actually, where I was employing people for the first time ever, and the people I was employing were quite often temporary staff. They may have, you know, been students. They might have been here for, like, you know, only a few months at a time. And quite often as well, because of my insecurity, I kind of looked to them to help me, because they were like catering people and I wasn't. I was like a chancer who just happened to have a few recipes that hit, and now suddenly people wanted them. And I remember thinking, my God, I'm in a commercial kitchen. I need to get the right staff. And so I employed the people who were there previously for the last company, which is a good thing in some ways. But in other ways, it also means they feel like it's still the previous company, the previous rules. You know, you're trying to talk to them about low-carb cooking and baking, and they're like, look, mate, it's just sugar or sweetener. Who cares? Like, no, this is really important.
Well, and especially if you're kind of, if you've shown that vulnerability in seeking their advice and put them in that position, at least for some things, of knowing best and somebody you're going to learn for. If you're then trying to change the way they've been doing things for ages, it's like, well, hold on a minute. You're the one who doesn't know what you're talking about. Yeah. And now you're trying to tell
us
to do it
here
a different way. Yeah.
And I learned the hard way some of that stuff. So there were times when I think now I shouldn't have done it that way, but that's how life works, isn't it? And you do learn as you go along. And there's been other times that I thought, actually, I could have said sooner to somebody before they got into bad habits. And it was just those sorts of challenges. But then what's been lovely in 2021 is that not long into the year, things did change, where now I have permanent staff who actually I've got a great deal of respect for, and vice versa. And that's been wonderful. Mm. And they enjoy working here, and I enjoy working with them. And I can now see career opportunities for them to develop their careers and new roles in the business as it grows. And that's actually what I wanted all along. And I guess this is how most things in life are. You know, you can't get to your destination necessarily without the bumps on the way. And that's just how it works. And so now I feel like that's actually helped me become better at what I do. And it's also meant that it's given me much more time back to plan for the business and where we're going. Because, you know, you're quite often in it, doing it day to day, baking, getting orders out, whatever it might be. You can't actually sort of look up and see where you're heading. And so to actually train people up who are now, and let's be honest, they're more capable than I am in many ways, because they do it all the time. And yeah. I do it now and again now. So I come in and I try a new flavor. I think, that's weird. I didn't invent that flavor. That's one of the first times that's happened. That normally it was like, oh yeah, I used to make that in my kitchen at home. Oh, now I've never made that myself, actually. How do you make it? And I'm learning from them. And it's that kind of respect, though, where I've got the time to develop the business and the new ideas. So for instance, we're going to have chocolate coming out next year. We did make some chocolate from the actual beans this year, but it's a very hard process. And the quantities we're making were so tiny that actually it wasn't really worthwhile doing it. You're talking about 48 hours of crushing down the beans and the sweetener and everything else just to get like a kilo at the end of it. It's like a heck of a long process. But we're getting bigger machines and that's going to develop. And I kind of feel like now I've got a bit more of the overview strategy stuff in place, and I've got time to do that, which really helps. And then I've got a team that I can trust and feel like we're working together. So yeah, that was a bit of a challenge for me, and it wasn't easy. But then I wouldn't have changed it for the world, because it's so true what they say about experience. You can't buy it. You can't bottle it and, you know, get it from someone. You have to go through it and experience it yourself, and you learn as you go through. And I think that's hard, but that's the only way you can do it, actually. So that's been interesting.
I'm very excited to try your chocolate. I keep missing that there's that magic window, because for anyone who doesn't know, and I'm sure all your listeners know, and some of mine might know, but you have this magic time on a Friday evening, 7 o'clock, when you have your restock, and there are always certain things. Well, a lot of the things are limited in their quantities. So unless you get in and you order it, often within like 3 minutes of 7 o'clock.
Yeah, it did get a bit crazy last year. Last January, February was really, really crazy. We had some stuff go within a minute or two. Mm. And I was like, this is, and that was when we were doing more production as well. But trying to keep up with that has been quite hard. The chocolate is an example. So because it is such a big process to do, we sold those out in, I think, 30 minutes. And that was a lot of chocolate we sold. And that was like 3 months of work and 30 minutes gone. And I was like, this is mad. So we do have that. And I think it's tricky to try to, make as much stuff as you can so that people get access to it, because it's basically adding to the burden of the staff. They've got their regular orders they get out each day, which is enough anyway. And this is the extra we do on top, which we try to learn about which flavors work and try to be as fair as possible. So if you're in our Deliciously Guilt-Free chat group, for instance, on Facebook, we do quite often poll and say, what would you like to bring out this week? Or what would you like to see in a restock in the future? And then that dictates what we do next. So, yeah, we do try to be as open to that conversation. But you're right, it can be a bit of a mad free-for-all sometimes on a Friday.
Well, and it's a balance. I can understand that from a production point of view. I mean, you know, you could ramp up production and get endless amounts of staff and all the rest of it and be producing a lot. But, this is a fresh product that you don't want to produce more really than you're going to sell either, because it's just going to spoil. This is not something that you can keep on a shelf for weeks on end. So it is that balance. So, you know, having that excitement and people primed, ready to fill their car at 7 p.m. on a Friday. But of course, if you're like me and you've been thinking about it and then you forget and all of a sudden it's 7:30 and you're like, oh, damn it.
Only a week to go to the next time.
I have you been there. Though. I've been there when I knew there were certain things. I think it was before my camping trip. And this was one of these examples of when you make a plan.
Yeah.
And I did take, you know, I cooked up bacon and eggs and different things to take with me. I ended up actually eating pretty well, apart from one meal out we had, eating all my own food. But I knew that one of the real danger moments would be when the sweet stuff came out, you know, when they'd make s'mores around the campfire and that kind of thing. And so I was determined that I was going to get my DGF order in. And there were certain things I wanted. So I was there ready and waiting and filled my cart within minutes of 7 o'clock to make sure I got what I wanted.
See, you plan ahead and it works in your favor for sure.
But that did make a huge difference. I have to say, you know, all the food I took helped, but particularly for me anyway, having a sweet tooth, if I hadn't have taken something, an alternative that I could have had, if I'd have gone along with my usual airy fairy nonsense, no plan of saying, oh, well, I won't have anything.
Yeah.
You know, in the moment, that's really, really difficult to do. You know, as I'd planned it, as it worked out, I had something that I could go and get so I could be having a sweet treat while everyone else was having theirs. And it was very easy to say, you know, when I was offered one, no, thank you, I don't want that because I've got my own.
That's cool. And actually, that's why we do it. So, you know, originally it was because Besma had gestational diabetes with both pregnancies. And this was a way just for us to have something we could enjoy without feeling like we're now compromising with her health and the health of our unborn children. And I kind of think, you know, sometimes we can talk about this if you like. There is certainly some people in the keto community, you know, some describe them as keto police, which might be unfair. But there are certainly people who say you should never have anything sweet. And I always think, well, that's subjective, you know. And actually, if you're somebody with an addiction issue around sweet things, then yes, I agree, you probably shouldn't have anything sweet. And I'll leave that to that person to decide what's right for them. However, to have an alternative where you don't feel like you're missing out, that's exactly what it's all about. And that's why this Christmas, I mean, Christmas is a really triggering time for me. I find that other times of the year I can easily go, I mean, like an Easter egg is a good example. I've not had an Easter egg in 10 years plus, and I'm absolutely fine with that. That doesn't trigger me, doesn't make me think, oh, I'm missing out in any way whatsoever. I don't really care for that. But a Christmas pudding or a mince pie, even though I swear to you now, if somebody said to me, you know, if I wasn't from Britain and I wasn't used to kind of Christian Christmas culture, and someone said, here's a mince pie, what do you think? I'll probably say, it's all right, but not for me, maybe. It's a bit sweet. Mm. But because it's the memory of Christmas and because it's the thing that I've had for the last 40 years, you know, like as a Christmas treat or whatever, I now think, oh yeah, actually, I like them because it's the familiar taste of Christmas. And so that's why we brought out mince pies and Christmas puddings and whatnot, because it's a case of saying, well, if you do feel like me, you're missing out on this stuff. It will never be exactly the same. Some people prefer them to the normal thing, and other people don't, because taste is very subjective as well. However, here is something that you can have as an alternative. And if that works for you, then why not? Mm. And I think that's only a healthy thing, really. I think what we come across quite often, though, and this is what I've learned the hard way as well, is that people's expectations of food are very different sometimes pre-keto and post-keto. And so we get people saying things just like you were saying about the shelf life. Why is the shelf life only 7 days, although you can freeze them for longer? Mm. It's like, well, because just like any real food, it doesn't last longer than 7 days outside of the fridge or whatever.
That's, I mean, right.
What are you expecting? That's a good thing. Like, if you're talking about a cake that's going to last 2 or 3 months on the shelf at room temperature, what is in there that's preserving its shelf life but maybe taking away your life?
Exactly.
And that's what I find we come across sometimes. People say, shelf life is far too short. It's only 7 days. I'm like, well, you just got to get realistic about what food is. And I think as a society, we're so warped in the way we think about food sometimes that people have lost that sense of what real food is. You know, you get a cauliflower, keep it in your fridge for 2 months and see what happens to it. That's just food. That's what it does. So so that is definitely, I think, a problem we face sometimes. But yeah, it's been a good year for us as a business. And next year is going to be exciting as well. I just think I have to find somehow a balance because I love what I do. But at the same time, like, I'm taking this afternoon off to take my daughter to the cinema because I think, you know what, I'm going to pick her up from school. We're going to go and see a Disney film, just the two of us. And actually, that's what life's really about, isn't it? It's about the relationships and that side. And I think last year I didn't have that as much as I should have done. And I think I'm readdressing that imbalance a little bit, trying to put it right and spend more quality family time as well.
I think that's a really good idea. And funny enough, I was talking to a friend of mine about the same thing. She was saying the same thing, that she had scheduled in, you know, designated times that yeah, she was going to do things like that, do some craft things with her boys or whatever it was. But these are, you know, scheduled times that she's taking out from the normal work week to do those things. Because, yeah, you're right. It is important. And especially with kids growing up so fast, some of those things, some of those moments in time that you can't get again. So unless you make the most of them now, it's not going to happen, or it's going to happen in a very different way, especially if they're approaching their teens.
Well, I can imagine that. So, you know, my daughter's six, she just turned six in September, so she's quite a young six. And for her, everything about this Christmas is magic, and Santa's magic, and the elf on the shelf. And we're doing a lot of these little cutesy things that she's into. And I think, yeah, one day she'll be 15, 14 and not want to spend time with me. And that's completely normal at that age. I get it. So I want to really appreciate this time. And best of my wife's PhD is coming to an end as well. So that's ending this month. And that's been hard as well, with her trying to, you know, work all the hours in the lab and me working on a business. It's been hard for our family. And I think readdressing that imbalance and saying, actually, you know what? Because in reality, I used to be trained to be a priest many, many years ago. And when I was, one of the things we had to think about was chastity and not having a family. And that was one of the main reasons that I had to leave, because I thought, no, that's not me. I'm definitely a family man. I definitely wanted to be a dad. I really strong feeling for that. And I remember saying back then, my dream was to have a family and to have children. That was all I wanted in life. And I've got it. So why don't I appreciate that more and spend more time with my family, if that's really what I know gives me the most amount of love and the most amount of joy in my life? Why don't I spend more time in it? And I kind of realized that this last year, thinking this business and the podcast and all the rest of it is great and I love it. And it can take as much time as you're willing to give it, and it will keep taking more. And your family can just be there and just accept you and not demand. And I think actually it's only right to then put the attention where it has to be, which is on my family and the ones I love.
Absolutely. I think that's very wise. And there are ebbs and flows, you know, when you have got a new business and you're wanting to build that business, and a big part of why you're wanting to build that business is for your family. So there is a bit of, you know, an ebb and a flow there. There's a period of time where you've got to put that extra energy into building that business and thinking about the longer term. But you're right. There's a danger that you just carry on with that, carry on wanting to build, take it to the next level, and you could keep on going, couldn't you? Ad infinitum. Yeah. But I think you're very wise in saying, okay, well, so we've taken it to that next level that was beyond where we thought we were going to be, you know, a year ago or whenever. It's going in the right direction, but now's a time I can take a bit of time back for my family, for those things that are important. And maybe it might be a case of, you know, rebuilding that energy to put more in, or let's see again, you know, when that might be necessary. It's being aware, like you say, of the things that are important.
And it's asking the why as well. You know, if you've grown a business forever and ever and ever, what, just to make it bigger or just to make it, I mean, it hasn't necessarily paid me well over the last few years. It's been a lot of grind for nothing in some cases, because I've known it's getting towards something that's going to be great. But actually, you know, if you're doing it while you're missing out on stuff you really love, like your kids growing up, then I think you've got to ask yourself some questions. Now, I've not got to that level, but I kind of think, yeah, actually, I have to, like, last winter was pretty brutal for me. I was working pretty much, well, definitely 6 days a week. I was working every Sunday. But quite often, really, if I'm honest, I was also working early Saturday mornings and late Saturday evenings on the business too. So, you know, when it gets to that stage, you suddenly think, well, okay, we're achieving stuff, but hang on a minute, that's now too much. That was the red line. And I think that's what I'm readdressing now. And yeah, and it's getting better. Another thing, the other thing that helped me massively as well with the podcast side is that I've got now somebody who helps me with the editing of the podcast. Now, I know you do everything, and that's incredible, because that, I know how much time that takes, and I know you've got a very high standard, so it takes you probably longer because you want to make sure it's the right standard to your podcast. But that is what I think helped me get some time back, because it is pretty intense. I think the thing that's been interesting there, not only do I now get the time back, but I also appreciate my podcast in a different way. So I now listen to my podcast. I'm a few weeks behind where we are in the podcast at the moment, because I listen to the shows where it's really like in my hazy memory bank, no, not that current, and I listen to it back now as a listener rather than the presenter, and I think, oh, I love the way they said that. I didn't pick that up at the time. Or, you know, when the guest is talking, I feel like the distance helps me to really appreciate and listen to what they're saying, that's been really quite pleasant, actually. Whereas before, I'd be editing it thinking, I've heard this podcast so many times now, I don't want to hear it ever again. And by the time it comes out, you think, whatever. Whereas now I'm like, actually, that one in October, I'll listen to it now. That was interesting they said that. And what do they mean? And so you can go into it. That's been really useful. But I was going to ask you about your podcast and how have you found post-move, trying to, you know, keep going with the shows and all the editing on the top of all that move. I mean, I imagine after a while you settled in, so you just get on with it again. But I was going to ask you about your year of podcasting and how that went.
And this is where we leave it for this week. So make sure to tune back in next week to listen to us chat more about podcasting. Thank you for staying with me right to the end. I hope you enjoyed that catch up with Dan. I say a catch up with Dan. It was mostly me rambling on about my move to the UK. So if you did stay with it, I hope you enjoyed it. And we'll come back next week to hear more from Dan and both of us just carrying on our chat. It was great, as always, to talk to Dan. He is a lovely, lovely guy. And I have to say that while I was editing, I was very much enjoying the rich baritone of his voice. I find his voice very soothing to listen to. As always, we're at that point where we wrap up with an end quote. And this week's end quote is from Glennon Doyle. Being human is not about feeling happy. It's about feeling everything. I hope wherever you are heading into a fantastic weekend and a lovely week. The last week before Christmas, if you're into Christmas, if you do Christmassy things, this is probably going to be a very busy weekend for you, but I hope a fun one too. So until next week, please take very, very good care, and I will see you soon. Bye-bye, keto lovelies.